Meeting of the House Interim Committee on Judiciary for Thursday, December 11, 2008.
I also call the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary to order.
We start out with a couple of information meeting topics before we move on to bill introduction, which is the main business of today. We will begin with a report on human trafficking, and I'd like to invite Representative Boone.
We need to call her by phone.
Oh, she's remote?
Yeah, she's remote.
Okay, and then Siobhan Sheridan Ayala and Keith Bickford.
Are they? They're both sitting up front. If they could come up to the witness table.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you will see in front of you a written report on human trafficking.
And should we go ahead and get our connection established? Okay. She's doing it.
When we get to the issue of bill introduction for the purposes of
okay. Did she not want to be called?
Chairman of the committee, she's in a meeting out of town, I believe, in Tennessee or someplace like that. And we contacted her and got her phone number in case we needed her for a quorum. But looking to your left, it doesn't look like
we think we're in good quorum problem. It's a good turnout today, so we're fine.
Which button do I press now? Okay. Okay. How many lawyers does it take to figure out a...
More than we have here. Apparently.
Just that one there. Representative Boone? Maybe hit that one. Representative Boone?
We're not getting any copy.
No.
There it is.
No, that's right.
Representative Boone? Hello?
Hi, I'm here.
Very good. We can hear you well.
Okay. And is this, what committee is it?
This is the Judiciary Committee's Representative Boone, the report on human trafficking.
Right.
House and Senate Judiciary Committee.
And we have your co-presenters at the dais at this time. So, Representative Boone, were you going to lead off the report, or did you want your co-presenters?
No, I think they're going to because I don't have it in front of me right now. So.
Okay. If you identify yourself with the record before you speak, that'd be great.
Yes, sir. My name is Keith Bickford. I'm a deputy for Multnomah County Sheriff's Office.
My name is Siobhan Sheridan Ayala. I'm an attorney.
Very good. Well, whichever you cares to lead off, please do so.
I guess I'll go first. Thank you. As I said, I'm a deputy for Multnomah County. My current position is the State of Oregon Human Trafficking Coordinator, which is a Bureau of Justice assistance grant. I started this position in October of 2007. The Trafficking Victims Protection Act defines trafficking as sex trafficking in which a commercial sex act is induced by force, fraud, or coercion, or in which the person induced to perform such an act has not attained 18 years of age, or the recruitment, harboring, transportation, provision, or obtaining of a person for labor or services through the use of force, fraud, or coercion for the purpose of subjection to involuntary servitude, peonage, debt bondage, or slavery. When I started this job, I did not have any training, and the only thing that the BJA folks told me was that I needed to find international human trafficking victims. I was never told where or how to find them, but once I figured out what I was doing, I uncovered a very dark and horrible world. Since no one I spoke with had any helpful input, I decided to train myself. I started reading about trafficking and looking into possible problems here in Oregon. What I found was a large underage prostitution problem in the Portland area and a system that was not equipped to help these girls if they were found. I also learned that there were a large number of international victims in Oregon, but they and their immigration attorneys were too afraid to contact law enforcement for help. Both of these problems were unacceptable, so I did what I thought was necessary to battle with it. I created three human trafficking task forces. The first task force consists of law enforcement, ranging from the head of the task force, Assistant U.S. Attorney Kemp Strickland, to FBI, Immigration, Customs Enforcement, and several different police departments and sheriff's office personnel. Our meetings take place every 2 months, and we discuss cases, training, and strategies for future task force plans. The second task force consists of victim advocates specifically committed to the underage prostitution problem. This group's focus is working with judges, DHS, mental health, to find a lawful way to secure these girls for their own safety. Most underage prostitutes are very difficult to take care of. Their first instinct is to run when caught, and when placed in foster care, 90% of the time, they run back to their pimp. I'm working with Transitions Global right now to find a secure facility for these girls. Transitions Global is a nonprofit organization who works with these types of girls all over the planet, and I know they are equipped to handle this problem for us. I believe they are the answer, and the task force will work on a lawful way to hold these girls. The third task force consists of mostly immigration attorneys from all over the state. One of my biggest challenges is finding international victims. They are not people who call 911 when they have an emergency. Most of them are afraid of law enforcement because in their countries, some of the police are corrupt. Most of these international victims are good, hardworking people who are just trying to find a better life for themselves or their family. When they arrive, they find nothing but hardship. They have entered a world of slavery in which, to them, there is no way out. I am looking as hard as I can to win the trust of both the immigration attorneys and their clients in order to help these people. The task force is currently working on numbers of victims in Oregon, both domestic and international. I believe that there are countless victims throughout the state, and I have promised myself to find each one. I realize that it's a big promise, but I see no other alternative. I'm dedicated to this job, and even though mine is the only job in the state of Oregon, I know I'm not alone. There are hundreds of regular people out there who want to join this fight with our task forces, and coalitions are forming all over the state from churches to colleges. I know that Oregon has a human trafficking problem, and I see no light at the end of the tunnel at this time. But I'm sure that with all the caring people around me, we can win this battle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. I wanted to talk about trafficking victims who are from other countries. And just to give you a little bit about my background, I served as the director of Catholic Charities Immigration Legal Services for 4 years. And during that time, we received a federal grant to serve trafficking victims, both to provide legal services and social services to the victims. And I'm currently in private practice, and I continue to serve trafficking victims. So that is still part of my work. But working at Catholic Charities, we were developing a program to work with law enforcement, and so it gave me a really good perspective on what's going on in Oregon. I can't talk about some specifics because of attorney-client privilege, but I can talk about generalities, and for certain cases I can talk about specifics. But I just want to tell you that it definitely exists in Oregon. And the types of trafficking that you see are very a broad range of situations. So you could talk about sex trafficking like what Keith was talking about. You also see labor, and it can be in terms of children, women, men, older men, younger men. So there's not like a stereotype of a trafficking victim, except for the fact that they are a very vulnerable person. So the fact that people come to the United States, and in the process of coming to the United States, there's basically the borders of our country are controlled in some ways by organized crime. And so when someone pays someone to come over to the United States, they're putting their life in hands of organized crime. And in that activity, they are subject often to trafficking at the border. If they're a woman, they can be raped. All sorts of abuses happen. And then they can get passed through to Oregon, and the exploitation can continue. Or the exploitation can happen in Oregon for the first time. So, but the fact of the person coming over here and sometimes having horrible experiences, facing possibly death or seeing other people die, puts them in a different state of mind where they feel more vulnerable than they might have felt in their own country. So my work is working with these people, trying to get them to talk with law enforcement, helping them apply for visas. The visa process can be very long. These clients they're very resource-intensive cases. They have a lot of needs. When you're talking about someone who's been subject to human trafficking, you're talking about someone whose spirit has often been broken or almost broken. So the needs that they have medical needs. They have, due to their victimization, they have psychological needs that are very big. And when I was working at Catholic Charities, we serve thousands of immigrants a year in helping them process legal papers. But the number of trafficking victims that we serve is very small comparatively. Over 2 or 3 years, it's about two dozen to 30 people. So it's a small number, but the resources that are required to serve these people and bring them out of the situation are very large. And one thing I would like to say to the committee is that it's been a learning experience for me, because you need to really step out of your comfort zone in order to help these people. And that means working as a partner with law enforcement. Of course, ultimately, my loyalty is to my client, but I have a different relationship with law enforcement than I had before. And that's for the benefit of the client. And it's the same thing with law enforcement. I think it's a little bit uncomfortable sometimes for law enforcement to work so closely with, you know, the immigration attorney or others. But it's for the benefit of this group of people. I guess I'll just end by saying that I really am excited that Oregon has passed the bill that it did, and that it is now a state crime to commit human trafficking. I don't know how many resources are being put towards it on a state level, but I'd be happy to entertain any questions you had. Thank you.
Representative Boone, did you want to add anything to the presentations that have been made?
To the what? All I wanted to say was, and I should have said this at the beginning, because I didn't know how much I had missed if you had started before I got called, but this is a little bit on the history of the bill, and that it started mainly by then Representative Carrie Gallego in 2005, and when she was not reelected, she had pre-session filed a bill that was mostly big fines for violations. Then she gave it to Karen Minnan from District 49 in 2005 to pass around. We tried that and failed. We reintroduced it in 2007, and it turned into creating this task force and recording this report. And here we are now. So.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to get a clarification, if I could. Detective, when you gave the introduction as to what the mission and the what is included within human trafficking, I didn't hear the phrase or the term international individuals, but then during the presentation I did hear throughout the presentation that we are talking, I'm assuming, about people that are actually coming to this state from other countries, as compared to someone that would be citizens of the United States that were engaged in prostitution. So we're really talking about people that are, for whatever reason, they're coming here from foreign lands, and then they're being exploited. Is that
correct? Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, maybe I can give some background that will help, particularly from the report. You may remember from last session we passed Senate Bill 578 that was mentioned earlier by Representative Boone. One of the things that we did afterwards was a work group put together, and you will see the work group that was people that participated over in page 3. We met probably about a dozen times early in the interim session. What we did is, through Kevin Campbell and the Chiefs of Police Association and the Sheriff's Association, we sent out questions. And you will see the questions on page 3 to all the sheriffs and chiefs of police. And then later the Portland police contacted us, the vice squad. Department of Justice also, through their victims assistance program, contacted people, nonprofits that provide services to people who are victims of domestic violence. One of the things I think that came out of this outreach and these information gathering is that it's a hard crime to find. It basically involves two distinct populations. One of them are people who are involved in international trafficking, as you've heard, who are vulnerable because of their legal status or lack thereof. And another population that is runaways, which probably involve different issues, different psychological issues, mostly in the sex trade, and with a lot of information came with a lot of cases out of Portland in that area. You have the report in front of you. I talked to Ronell Schenkel yesterday, and I understand that this is an issue in the report. It recommends the Department of Justice coordinate this, DOJ, and I believe I understand that will be the case. They will do some coordination in this area. A lot of it may be simply bringing resources that already exist to the table in education of law enforcement and providers of public services, because it's hard to recognize this issue and this crime when it comes to you, because as you've heard, people don't readily volunteer that they are in these circumstances.
Judy, any questions for witnesses, Representative Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant Bickford, in your comments, you addressed that you dealt with girls. What did she say?
Speak up.
Hi, Debbie. You talked about that you had noticed a number of girls in your research and investigations, and that would this apply equally to boys and young men who might be caught up, to your knowledge, in this?
Yes, and my plan is there are so many coalitions and things being formed for these little girls that I'm just going to kind of piggyback the boys along with that, and just kind of like I said, you know, there's so much stuff going on for these little girls. The little boy problem does exist, yes. It's not as obvious, I guess, you know, through the internet and things like that the little girls are, but we are looking into that as well. That's definitely something to take into consideration.
Thank you. An additional question, Mr. Chair?
May.
Thank you. And Ms. Ayala, as you have worked in these matters too, just for clarification, I think it would be helpful that we know that this is not specific to a particular community or ethnic origin. I had people in my office a number of times from various communities that are very concerned about this.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if anyone saw, there was an Oregonian article about a woman from Ethiopia, who was in a domestic servant situation, actually here in Salem, and she's one of my clients. There's also been people who are from Central America, Mexico, Russia, all over the world. I mean, there's really, unfortunately, there's no discrimination in that regard of who can become a victim. One thing I would also like to add, which I meant to say in my earlier comments, was that any activity where immigration and local law enforcement are cooperating together is going to put more fear into the population of people who are being victimized, because they're going to have less trust in coming forth. Because the ultimate fear of these people is, well, oftentimes they're working to pay off the supposed debt, say like $20,000. That they got into by coming over here. And then the threat of the worker, of the person who's making them work, is that you're going to get deported and you're still going to owe me this money. I'm going to come after your family. And so if they think that coming forward they're going to then get deported, they're less likely to do that. So.
Any further questions? Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. On page 4, it says toward the just above the survey of the Oregon Department of Justice, it appears that most of the Portland cases and the cases before the United States Attorney's Office involve forced prostitution of underage girls, with all but a few being native born. That would indicate that, at least in our largest metropolitan area, that it's really not so much of an international problem as it may be a problem of our own.
That's correct. I would say a good number are domestic. And that comes from talking with the folks in the bias unit.
Could you elaborate on that a little more on how that comes to pass?
Well, I guess the biggest thing for me is right now I've noticed a lot of recruitment in our high schools and our junior highs. The average age is of one of these young ladies is 15 to 16 years old. What we did notice is that talking with a couple of temps, a high school is a great way to recruit. The girls that you're looking for are there. A lot of these, basically these pimps can hide in plain sight. They can attend the school and get their business done while they're there. And they don't care whether these girls have lots of money or no money at all, confidence, whatever. They find whatever girls they can find and whoever they can reel in, they will recruit them. So I haven't noticed really a certain type of young lady that's specifically being picked on. And like I said, you know, the high school is full of these girls, and the boys know that, the pimps know that. And so one of my biggest targets right now is educating the high schools and junior highs, trying to get in and talk with the teachers, counselors, the school resource officers, and just start kind of a mass education throughout the state of Oregon if I can.
One follow-up, please.
Go ahead.
To what extent, to your knowledge, is this servitude related to the drug trade?
I haven't seen much of that in the drug trade. I do know on occasion some of the adult prostitutes that I've talked to have part of their job besides the prostitution has been trafficking drugs to different states. But I haven't seen, personally, I have not seen a large amount of that.
There was a case that was brought to indictment by the U.S. Attorney's Office and was ultimately settled that involved trafficking with drug. It was done by people who were growing drugs in Oregon. So there is some, it was a Mexican-based drug cartel.
Just one.
Yes.
Just one more.
Go ahead.
And that is, I think I had more in mind, are these young people being hooked on drugs and then being hooked on servitude and prostitution in order to service their habit of using drugs?
From the vice folks I've talked to, the pimps have noticed that these younger girls get more money when they look healthy, so they have kept them off drugs. They're trying to keep them off the alcohol, and basically this is just brainwashing. These guys are as good as it gets when it comes to the brainwashing. So the girls that are brought in, there isn't as much beating either, so they look a lot healthier and just look a lot better, so, and that brings in a more clientele.
Thank you.
Taylor.
Mr. Bickford, I thought I heard you say in so many words that the pimps, in many cases, are students in the same high schools and are pimping their fellow students. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Deputy.
Deputy.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure the record's straight because I think we're mixing two different situations here. What I'm hearing is on the domestic side is really forms of prostitution as compared to human trafficking. So I keep on hearing those interchanged, and I think it's important that we make sure the record's clear that human trafficking, from what I heard you say, is defined to include some component of people that are coming in to the country from some other foreign nation as compared to being a student who's a U.S. citizen at a high school who may be engaged in prostitution and being pimped or whatever it may be by a fellow student. And Is that correct?
That's correct. The underage, under the age of 18, if they are prostituting themselves, that is considered trafficking. And then you have the international side where people are coming to the United States for whatever reason. That would be the international side of it.
All right, so you're saying that we have redefined under SB 578 or whatever bill that was as to say that now if you're under the age of 18, that is a form of human trafficking.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
But does it require that there be some compulsion by another individual, at least? Or is it, if there is an underage person who engages in prostitution on that person's own initiative, is that human trafficking?
Yes, it is. As long as they're under 18, a lot of these girls claim that they're doing it because they want to. And that goes along with the brainwashing, but as long as they're under that line, it's considered trafficking.
I mean, it strikes me that there's a complex of problems of compulsion, but I'm just wondering whether perhaps the definition has been extended to include activity that's very unfortunate, but maybe has a dimension that doesn't involve the compulsion that seems to be at the core of what human trafficking is all about. Any reactions to that?
I mean, I understand, but I think the other factor is talking with one of these young ladies. After a certain amount of time, you get down to the core of the problem. They are just brainwashed. They say they want to do this, but basically they've just been taken advantage of. You know, inexperience, age, whatever you want to call it. That's why I believe that they just want to call everything under that age trafficking.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have there been many prosecutions under the new statute, and if so, what's been the outcome of those?
Hasn't been very many just yet. One of the things that Kemp Strickland, the U.S. attorney, wants to do starting for next year is have a lot more of these cases brought to him so he can prosecute and finish this all the way to the end. So those numbers are a little embarrassing right now. I think I can think of three right now that were all had something to do with underage prostitution, I believe.
Yeah, and working with a victim, sometimes what you've got is the person clearly appears to be a trafficking victim, but it's not going to be something that's going to be able to be prosecuted because there's just not enough corroborating evidence. So that's another issue that comes up, and sometimes, you know, we talk in different languages because I'm talking with the person and this is their story and it seems to be consistent and clear, but then whether or not that would stand up in court to prosecute something is a different standard. So that's been a barrier as well.
Thank you.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we have a Measure 11 offense, right, called compelling prostitution. And the U.S. attorney's interest in these kind of crimes is because they're going across state lines? Is that the issue?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Parker.
I know there's programs to help these young women get out of there and everything. Do you know how that looks in this upcoming budget, how those programs?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear
it. There's programs to help young women get out of prostitution, and I know the police try to get them into those programs. And I was wondering if you know if and how those programs might be affected by the budget, the upcoming budget crisis.
I couldn't answer specifically that issue.
Thank you.
I talked to Keith Strickland last night, and similar discussion that we've had here, I traditionally thought that the feds got involved when it was a violation of the Mann Act and taking someone across state lines. But what he tells me, their reach is a lot longer and a lot broader now. For example, it involves potential of interstate commerce. For example, someone uses a cell phone. Someone uses a hotel or motel that's involved in interstate commerce. So I said to him, so you're saying this would cover probably about 85% of the prostitution cases? And he said, yes, it would. So it's not just the traditional Mann Act that we've all heard about and know about. And I also want to, on the report, one of the recommendations is have the Urban Criminal Justice Commission track the number of criminal prosecutions each year for human trafficking. Now, I don't anticipate a lot of cases under here, because what you have with the statute is a lot of overlap in the sense that a lot of this activity is defined beforehand, and my sense is that the district attorneys and police will be more familiar with the old crimes and probably charge under that. And as Representative Shields mentioned, if I'm correct, compelling prosecution is a Measure 11 offense, too. So you have penalties under those provisions. This bill is part of a national effort. Most states have adopted this. It was urged by the federal government that all states do this. The federal government has adopted similar legislation. So this is the follow-up to that effort. Representative Boone mentioned to go even earlier than that.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think before I was even instated in the legislature, I attended a meeting at NCSL, and there was a lot of activity in one of their subcommittees around this sector.
Representative Shields. Thank you, Mr. Chair. More of a comment than a question. It just seems to me that we have a huge problem in this hemisphere of particularly women coming from Central America, leaving their homes, traveling incredibly dangerous journeys by train with babies through Mexico, and I'm sure some of them make their way into Oregon under awful conditions, violence every step of the way. That seems like I hope the federal government doesn't focus all of its resources on prostitution, which can also be dealt with local law enforcement, that they instead put a big look at the people who are helping women and exploiting them all the way through Central America and Mexico, and a large part of those issues that, you know, are economic ones, but that's a topic for another day. But Representative Boone, or any of the presenters, do you get a sense that the federal government is also very much interested in the problem I just described of the dangerous travel through Mexico and Central America?
Absolutely. And actually, originally, the federal funding was almost exclusively towards the international issue, and then I think there was a broadening of the perspective that to include domestic. However, there's just, I think you really described it well. The problem is, and I don't work with the domestic victims, but it's immense when you're dealing with just even one person, because the violence that they've been experiencing, the isolation, and then the brainwashing when they're so isolated, they can be in a situation for years. So undoing that damage, it takes a lot of resources. And I think, I don't know how the budget is going to affect the resources, but if Oregon could even put even more resources towards serving victims, I don't really know if it should discriminate between domestic and international, because, you know, it's sort of like, well, who's more worthy of a victim? Who's more worthy of a person to serve? Well, ultimately, we're just dealing with a human being who's experienced, who's been a victim of a crime in our state.
Thank you. Any further questions?
One, I guess this is a request for counsel. I've looked through the words and phrases. I don't see anywhere in the words and phrases the human trafficking. And so I'd like to know whether or not we've actually defined it under Senate Bill 578. The report doesn't make it clear, but I'd like to make sure we have some clarity if we're going to actually be dealing in this area, mm-hmm. exactly what human trafficking is, because to me it seems like we're mixing what has been traditional types of crime. And I'm not saying that it's right, but I'm saying is that we need to make certain we know what we're talking about, because if the feds are working under one component and we don't really have it defined, it kind of puts us at a disadvantage as to how do we actually address these various important issues, and do we have the same type of resources available for the, call it the human trafficking side, as compared to on the domestic side. What I'm hearing is that we now have kids within schools that are basically maybe coercing their classmates into this type of trade.
So I would like to make certain that we have something there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, human trafficking is a generic term. On page 2, under background, Senate Bill 578 created the crimes of subjecting another person to involuntary servitude in trafficking in persons. A person commits a crime of involuntary servitude when the person forces another to engage in conduct the person would otherwise would not have engaged in. A person commits the crime of trafficking in persons when the person recruits, transports, or harbors another person knowing that the other person will be subject to involuntary servitude. So the human trafficking is a generic term, a base term that uses much in the press to cover basically two distinct parts of it, one the person being trafficked and the other the person doing it.
Okay.
Mr. Taylor, we're talking about, you know, apparently international trafficking and domestic trafficking, and domestic trafficking appears to be related perhaps to pimping in middle schools and high schools. Has this committee or has anyone actually surveyed the Department of Education to find out whether they are, whether this is on their horizon and what they're doing about it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so was it, that's the one group we did not survey because during our meetings no one mentioned it. We could probably send a letter to them on behalf of the committee, but my experience for with the high schools is they basically focus on education and they're not focusing on tracking crime. But as I said, we could do it.
It seems like this is a process that is hiding in plain sight in our schools.
This is Representative Foon. I think we should write to them and alert them to this, send them a copy of the report, and especially the part, I couldn't hear all of the presentation on that, but I just wanted to be tested and let them know that. It would be terrible to not do that, assuming that they already know, and I don't.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I would think that any teacher or counselor in a school would have a mandatory reporting for suspected child abuse, would they not?
Chair, members of the committee, I think Senator Bonamici is correct. If a counselor were to know that a student under the age of 18 was being sexually abused, a teacher, as we as attorneys, would have the obligation, and you as legislators would have the obligation to report that through appropriate channels to DHS. And our next group will be Erin Kelly Seelig, so I'm sure she could probably talk a little bit about that if you wanted it to, as far as reporting goes. But, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. But once again, they'd have to know it.
Right.
Anything further on this topic? Questions or comments? Well, then, I want to thank our presenters. Representative Boone, thank you very much for being with us by telephone. Ms. Sheridan Ayala, Mr. Deputy Bickford, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Are we finished with this at
this point? We are going to go on and talk about placement of children in foster care, and so you can remain with us if you're interested in that, Representative Boone, or we can let you sign off.
I think I'm going to sign off. I'm not in any way uninterested in it, but I have another appointment.
Very good.
So thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you for joining us.
Right.
Thanks, Debbie. Okay, now we'll move on to the next item in our informational meeting. It is a report on the placement of children in foster care pursuant to Senate Bill 413. Our presenters will be Kevin George from DHS and Erin Kelly Seal, also from DHS.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Erin Kelly-Seal, and I'm the Interim Director for the Children, Adults, and Families Division in the Department of Human Services. And we're here today following up on a bill that was passed in 2007, Senate Bill 413, requesting that the agency provide a report to the legislature prior to the legislative session, giving you some updated information about children in foster care. What is being handed out for you right now is a much broader report that we do out of our Child Welfare Division that describes looking back over the last fiscal year, which is the year that we collect data, looking over that last fiscal year for 2007, giving you some perspective, which I'd like to put out there for some context, beyond just foster care, but the number of reports and abuse and neglect that we receive, a little bit about our foster care system, about what happens to children exiting foster care, and about some of the challenges and opportunities we face. I think Kevin and I both recognize this is probably just the very beginning of a conversation with this committee, or the continuation is probably a better way to frame it. This committee, both of the committees present today, have actively been involved with our organization around efforts to improve the policy and practice that supports both children in foster care, that prevents child abuse and neglect, and that supports efforts to get children who are in foster care into safe permanent placements, and we look forward to continuing that discussion. But for context, most recently about what's been happening in this arena, in 2007, our agency received over 63,500 reports of child abuse and neglect. We investigated over 26,380 of those, and in those investigations determined that 10,716 Oregon children were victims of child abuse and neglect in 2007. I think it's notable that about 50% of those children were under the age of 6. And I think that looking at some of the demographics, more of which are present in the report, is helpful to inform our effort to actually get ahead of the problem and prevent child abuse and neglect in the first place. Looking in that direction, alcohol and drug issues are the single largest challenge facing families in which abuse is present. And for our foster care system specifically, about 55% of children in foster care have one parent or more who is addicted to drugs or alcohol. Other significant factors include parental contact with law enforcement and domestic violence. So again, looking at ways that we could get ahead of having a child become a victim, I think focusing in on those areas makes the most sense when you look at the numbers. Looking at the number of kids in foster care, there were over 15,000 children in Oregon that spent at least one day in foster care in the year 2007. On any given day in Oregon, there are anywhere between 9,000 and 9,500 children in foster care. About 7,000 of those are being served in what we call family foster care homes. 30% of kids who are 30% of that 7,000 are being cared for by relatives. You may recall last session the legislature authorized us to actually begin reimbursing relatives to pay who provide foster care or provide care is really the better way to frame it for children who are in need of protective services. And we again really want to recognize and appreciate that policy change by the Oregon legislature in 07. Kevin in a moment is going to talk a little bit more about the experience that children are having in foster care and report on some really specific information that updates this 2007 data for you around specifically the issues of children, their sibling placements, and the number of their placement stability while in care. But I want to point out that about 64% of children who are in foster care in Oregon go home to their families. That I just want to repeat that, 64% go home to their families. Again, I think illustrating the need for us to concentrate on what it means to be a safe family environment for these children. Most of them go home. 18% end up being adopted. 6% end up in what we call permanent guardianship situations. About 6% are emancipated, and there is another 5%, which this committee also has spent some time on looking at the issues around runaway and homeless youth that are connected somewhat to those children in our foster care system that unfortunately we are unable to continue to provide services to. There are a couple of goals that we are working on addressing in our child protective service area. Really, safety is, of course, paramount for us. That is our charge and mission, is to keep children safe. In the context of that, though, I think we've looked at our data and understand that as compared to other states in the country, Oregon tends to remove more children and place them in foster care. And we are asking ourselves why that is and what we can do to better support efforts on the front end with families to keep children safely at home. What we can do also to improve our ability for those children who are in foster care to exit foster care more quickly in a more timely way, and what we can do to increase resources like adoptive resources that might be available for those children and also improve our timeliness and ability to work on those issues. We, of course, also have a focus around the improvement of safety, and particularly for us right now, we're very focused on the health and mental health of children who are in our foster care system and have a series of strategies underway to really make some efforts of to improve the outcomes that our children who are in foster care have with respect to their health and mental health. Some of the challenges that we're facing, again, just trying to get through some context for you before Kevin gets you into the weeds around some data. We have obviously resource challenges, as does the rest of the state, and as we look at those initiatives, of course, supports and challenges, our efforts to support parents better, to support out-of-home caregivers like foster parents and relatives better, are challenged significantly as a result of some of the resource issues that we're facing. Other significant challenges for us include the fact that we recently had a study done of our workforce that illustrated that all of the mandates that have been put on our system, both at the federal level and state level, all of which are really good policy and good mandates for us to have. We currently, it is estimated by this outside company, McKinsey, have about 24 to 37, we are about 34 to 20, 30, I'm sorry, let me start again. We are about 24 to 37% understaffed as compared to the workload and demands that are upon our staff right now. And so the kinds of things like going out and seeing a child every 30 days at least, face-to-face contact, is something you may have been hearing about. We have a rule and statute that requires us to make contact with every child, requires our workers to make contact with every child at least once every 30 days. That can be hard to do when you are 24 to 37% understaffed. The good news is we are making those targets in over 80% of our cases right now, but we'd like to be at 100% of our cases, if at all possible. Again, we've got some efforts underway to improve our process and improve the way we do our work. One example of that, which Representative Flores, Representative Krieger are very well familiar with, involves our adoption process. We are looking at ways to streamline that process, taking our average time to process a child who's ready to be freed legally for adoption down from 200 to 400 days, which is the current cycle time, to 45 days. That would make a huge difference in the life of a child who's ready for a permanent home and also help us in our effort to have that child exit foster care. Some of the opportunities looking ahead and good news that I just want to make sure you're aware of. In many of your communities, one of the things that's very exciting to us is that even in these very challenging economic times, the public and the community are really rising and wrapping around the Child Welfare Department and asking us what they can do to help us achieve some of our goals in this area and help us serve kids and keep them safe both at home prior to entry to foster care and help us keep them safe while in care. And we are incredibly appreciative and about the opportunities we have to work with communities, setting some really clear targets for ourselves in that work and really measuring our progress so we can report to you on that and what that looks like tangibly. And I think it's really important also just to know, for you to know, last night I was able to spend some time with foster parents and foster children at Mahonia Hall with the governor and the first lady. And I'm incredibly impressed each time I get the opportunity to meet with them. Some of them were relatives caring for their relatives' children. Some of them were strangers who were just out of the goodness of their hearts caring for children. All of the children were beautiful and impeccably behaved. And I think looking at your situation and often some of the conversations I have with all of you, I know that you often hear about the cases that don't go well, cases that are challenging for families, challenging for our system. But I really do want to remind you that there is a lot of really good work happening in this area, that kids are being kept safe, and that there is really positive change happening in the lives of kids and families as a result of all this. Kevin's going to go into a little bit more detail around our foster care system, some of the challenges that we have with respect to keeping kids together with their siblings and keeping them in a stable placement, and we'll be happy to answer any questions when that part of the report is finished.
Very good.
Hey, good morning. Chairperson McPherson and Prozanski, my name is Kevin George, and I work as a foster care manager for Department of Human Services. And I appreciate the time we'll have to talk about here. I was struck a little bit by Aaron's response saying I was going to talk about the weeds, the data down in the weeds, and maybe that's exactly where it is. But so I'll get into some of the data report here that has been passed out to you. So you all received the larger status of children report. We're not going to go through that. What I am going to do is try to walk you through the supplemental sheet that you had, which is about a three-page front-and-back copy. Again, as we started, this report is a result of a bill, Senate Bill 413, that was passed last year in the legislature, or last session, and it was really championed by Senators Brown, Cruz, and Representatives Krieger and Schaffler, who had a number of bills in child welfare. And so this is one where they really wanted to start talking about, as an interim committee, people need to get information ahead of time, ahead of session, and get kind of up to speed on what's going on within the child welfare system, and specifically around placement stability. So how many times children are moving in care, how many children are in care, and how many siblings, that kind of information. So within the report, you'll see that we've tried to identify and answer each of those questions that are in the statute. But when you're looking at the number of children on page one, it really talks about the overall numbers of children in care in 2000, again in 2007. And when I'm talking about the numbers of children, some of you who have been very close to this issue have been hearing about the numbers of children are smaller, you know, 8,000, 7,000, 6,000. And so when reporting 9,000 children, what's the difference? At the federal government level, they define foster care as the broad range of foster care. If the child is out of their, physically out of their home, so whether they're in a family foster care setting, they're in a residential treatment setting, psychiatric hospital, shelter programs, any of those kind of placements are considered foster care. As well as the federal government defines foster care as those children who were in those settings and now have gone back home and are home for a short period of time, but they're still legal custody, they still count that as foster care. So when we talk about the number being 9,000 children in care, that includes those children, some of those children who have actually gone home. So when Ms. Kelly Seale talked about 7,000 children in family foster care, I think that's the number most of us are more comfortable with, and that's indeed what we're talking about right now. So 30% of the children who are in our system have had one placement. The other 70% have had more than one placement. So that's all the children who have been in our system everywhere from one day to several years that they've been in foster care. And that's what those numbers talk about there on the first page. This is also a federal government measure where they look at Child and Family Services Review, which is a federal audit that comes out. And ours was done in 2 years ago. And what they found in our system was that they actually tried to break that stability issue even more finely in a granular model and say, of all those children in care less than 12 months, how many are moving around? Children, and so on page two, you'll see a bar graph that actually talks about that in terms of what the national median is and where Oregon stands, the first bar being 2007, the second bar being 2008. As you can see, we're right on target at the national median anyway for children in the first 12 months and children between 12 months and 24 months in care, and then over 24 months, we actually are above the national median in that those areas right there. So those are good, although it continues to need to be better in many, many ways. When you get to page three, and I want to just kind of keep walking through these, you know, fairly quick pace, and feel free to stop me if you have more questions. Page three is one where we are providing a full report of all the children in care, how many placements they've had over time. And you'll start looking down. The one that jumps out, hopefully jumps out to you, is the one that talks about 70 placements. And why is this child at the very bottom there have 70 placements? And when we go in and start looking at what we've got is both we have some placement issues with kids, but we also have some data problems where if we have a foster parent who may have the child and on Friday they may go over to the Johnsons for the weekend for a respite care situation. In our system currently, we actually will close that out as a foster care placement with the George family, move them to the Johnson family. He comes back on Sunday, he comes back in the George home, that child has had three moves. So our data integrity issues remain a problem. We're doing some work on that by developing different service codes.
Senator,
yes.
I would just wonder how much book work and staff time would be required to keep track of that information, which appears to be totally useless.
Senator, that's exactly my challenge with saying, why does that make sense? Does it make sense? No, it does not make sense to do that, both a bookwork and somebody sitting in front of a computer opening a service and closing a service. It really ties into the issue that we need to make sure we know where our kids are at all times, but that one ties directly into a payment issue. And we're trying to do some work right now on one of the primary issues that foster parents speak to each and every session that they come up here and talk to me frequently and others of you is around the need for respite care and a very concerted, well-defined respite care program. And if we can actually move in that direction, develop a respite care program through some of the work we're doing, that will take care of some of those issues.
Would community nurseries help to address that issue?
The community nursery, some of that helps. We actually really look at respite care pretty wide. So sometimes it's daycare centers, sometimes it's other folks taking care of kids in the neighborhood. We really have a pretty wide range of respite care. Our basic bottom line issue really comes down into we don't have a consistent funding source right now for a full-fledged respite care program. And that's one of the things we're working on. And then the whole data integrity issues. How else is there ways to measure where this child is moving without having somebody sit in and open and close services?
Thank you.
So I'm going to walk us then to the next page, which is on page 4, and it starts talking about placement connections. And one of the things we know very clearly is that kids will do better if they maintain some of their connections. So for a number of years, we've worked on things such as neighborhood foster care, keeping children in their same placements. The education system has worked really well with us the last several years, and we've done a lot of school-based recruitment. So going into schools and recruiting for foster homes, trying to keep the children in their same school. And so they have some abilities to maintain those friends in the same school, that teacher in the same school, even if we've had to move them out of that neighborhood for a variety of reasons. And so those things are really moving in the right direction. So when you look at the overall number of trying to keep those some of those stability, as Aaron talked about, 30-31% of our children are with relatives. Again, that permanent connection for these children, which they need to have throughout their life. We're doing some work around looking at the reconnecting families projects, too, where children who have been in situations where they may have lost connections with their family for a variety of reasons, how do we actually bring some of those relatives back in? How do we reconnect some of these children with relatives, with friends? And we've done a lot of things around modifying our rules on certification of foster homes so that we can actually find non-traditional foster parents to help care for these kids. When you look at actually the number then, I won't read the whole thing on page 4 to you, obviously, for the where all these kids are at, but again, the numbers of children placed with a certified relative in Oregon is at 26% right now. And again, Oregon requires certification of relatives for children to be placed with them. Page 5 gets into sibling issue, and we spent time last legislative session really talking about, again, it's that connections for children, and one of the primary connections is their siblings. And, you know, for most of us that have siblings, that'll be the longest relationship you have with anybody in your entire life, longer than your parents, longer than your spouse. It's your siblings. And so what do we do about supporting that? And quite frankly, I'm real proud to say we are at 80% of our children that have siblings that are placed together, either all together or partially together. And that's a good goal. The goal is obviously much higher to 100% of having all children. But when you get faced with the reality of Friday afternoon, you've got a sibling group of 4 children, of 5 children, of 8 children, and where do they go? To one home, to multiple homes. So the strategies for those things are such things as family decision meetings, and how do you bring families together and say, look, these children obviously are not safe in this environment. Are there other family members that can step forward and help out? Are there neighbors? Are there teachers? Are there friends of the family? And so we do quite a bit of those kind of child-specific certifications of foster homes for these children. But we do a fairly good job with that, but we can certainly do better. And most often what I hear from young people who have left the foster care system when they're older. They talk about what was the most important to them. It really wasn't about that they got the right pair of shoes or they went to the right high school. It was that they had somebody who believed in them and they had a connection to one of their siblings, if indeed that's they had siblings. So the sibling connection piece is one we've got to continue to do and work on. And there's a variety of initiatives out there. One's called Camp To Belong, where sibling groups who can't live together for whatever reason actually get to go and spend a week together. We talk about increased visitation in this last couple years around how do children visit and keep that sibling connection, as well as making sure that they're open to text messaging and internet and Facebook and all the other ways that young people actually communicate now. I'm going to end there with actually those elements and be happy to answer any more questions folks have without getting more defined in the detail.
Very good. Representative Krieger.
I have about an hour.
Well, we do appreciate the leadership that you've brought forward on these issues, and it was this report and this work wouldn't have gone advanced without your
It was good work
efforts.
And everybody that took part really enjoyed it. We passed legislation that gave relative placement preference. And it appears, talk to me about, has it gone down by percentage?
Yes, Representative Krieger, when you look at the percentage number, when we're talking about, I'm quickly looking for my page.
Page four.
Thank you. Down from 27 to 26%. One of the things that you may have also heard is that there's also a significant number of foster homes. We've decreased the number of foster homes as well. Part of it is that there are a significant number of those that have been relatives. One of the things that we don't have the data ready to share at this point in time, though, is that one of the other strong emphasis was looking at if there are reasons why this child needs being cared, can we get to the relative and certify them right away? How many of these children could potentially be with a relative that are not placed by the agency then? So can grandma step in and say, we don't need to go to court over this child. I can take them in right now and take care of them. So we're seeing a little bit of that because what we're seeing is a decrease in the number of some of the kids coming in foster care. And we're also seeing that when we're talking about how long kids come into foster care and then go home right away, which I know is an issue that you've raised and Representative Senator Cruz, around if the child can come into foster care and go home in a couple days, what could we do to make sure that child didn't have to come in the first couple days anyway? And we're seeing a decrease in those numbers as well. So I think in a combination of different things, that's really what's playing out. I don't know that I can really say specifically we have X number of homes. This is exactly the reason. I think there's several factors going to that. But we have changed rules. We are trying to recruit relatives. We're in the process of doing relative search policies and some other things right now as well.
Talk to us a little bit about in the best interest of the child. We see that in statute. And how does that play in when you make your decisions? In other words, it's almost like it's an intangible thing, and how do you measure it? This psychiatrist would say this, or this doctor would say that. And a lot of the arguments that you see for not putting children back, or maybe not letting and where I'm really going with this is where I see the lack of grandparents' visitation rights. I mean, every phony excuse that I've seen your agency has used, and I've got a list of them, and I'm not happy about it. And the work group's going to continue to come after you until you've got to do better than what you have. You know, I've talked to Mickey Cerise, I've talked to Dr. Goldberg, and it has gone on. For 4 years, this work group has been working in a very bipartisan way. The agency has made, I feel, some headway. But I'm not happy where we are after 4 years. And I place it on a couple of things. One is, and I want you to get to this, your caseworkers can't possibly do the job that they need to be doing with the number of cases, so I want to know how many cases they're carrying. And how does that compare to some of the other states? Because you can't expect them to make that personal contact and really be up to date on those individual cases. if they've got 100 of them, they should have 30. Can you talk to me about the caseload and how that relates back with how things seem to be happening too slow? And part of it's the mindset of the agency, I think.
Co-chairs, Representative Krieger, we'd be happy to come back and do a full report for you on what the transition that's going on right now within child welfare to move away from a caseload model to a workload model. We can tell you, we do, of course, have statistics around the number of cases that all of our workers are carrying, but there's recognition in the field right now that the complexity of cases is not always the same. You could have a case involving a single child with two parents, neither of whom are very interested in continuing to parent the child, who voluntarily relinquished very early on in the case. That case is not the same as a case where you have three or four children, each of whom have different fathers, perhaps have different mental health or behavioral health issues, and the parents are struggling with domestic violence, addiction issues, and you have grandparents that want to be involved. Those would each count under a caseload model as a single case for a worker, but obviously in terms of the work the worker would be required, that would be required of a worker in each of those cases, the workload is very different. So we have been making a concerted effort to transition the conversation away from what's the ratio of cases for each worker to what's the workload that is required of each worker and how do we compare and where are we in terms of where we would like to be. You're absolutely correct that our workload challenge is very significant. It impacts significantly our ability to spend time on cases, to do upfront some of the kind of search for relatives that I think before we've very much wanted to do, but sometimes in some cases have not had the opportunity to do. So I think what I'd like to be able to offer the committee is to come back and do a more full report on the detail around the transition from a work caseload to a workload model and tell you, you know, for each kind of worker that looks a little bit different. Just to comment also about the mindset of the organization. Again, I think we would agree that we have some significant challenges within DHS around bringing some level of standardization and consistency to our practice, as well as setting very clear and tangible policies, which we've been in the process of doing around what it means to keep a child safe, what our role is in that, what it means to keep a child at home, how we evaluate what we call the protective capacity of a parent, how do we work with the court system to understand whether a parent has not just completed all of the check-the-box requirements on a case plan, but who has actually developed the ability to really safely parent the child. And I think that we've actually made pretty significant progress in making some policy change around the issue of safety. What we often run into when we have those discussions in communities, in some communities there's significant frustration with that effort because they view it as an effort for us to stop taking care or intervening in certain family situations. In other communities, they see us as being over-involved in family lives and getting, you know, being too aggressive in terms of our work with families. You speak about the challenge in defining the issue of best interest and how that is informed. And I think that one of the things that always I like to remind folks is that although caseworkers for child welfare play a very significant role in the life of a case, we also work with partners, attorneys, and the courts to make determinations like what is in a child's best interest. And the court system, when they do that, rely both on recommendations from the agency, from the child's attorney, often from ACASA, from therapists and others, as they make decisions about who can have visits, where the child is placed, et cetera. So I think it's important to recognize that our workforce does have significant challenges. We are working hard to identify specifically what those are, where they come into play, how we can address them, what are statewide issues versus local issues, but also working hard with our partners like the courts to improve the way we work together and partner on making the best decisions we can for kids and families.
Got a couple follow-ups.
Okay.
We graduated 13 CASAs in Coos County, I think it was Wednesday. I went down and watched that, and then were sworn in by Judge Stone. And during the work group over the last 4 years, that was one of the things we wanted to eventually get to. We've got a CASA for every kid. How close are we? Would you say we are? Statewide, is it pretty good in some areas and lacking in other areas?
Co-chairs and Representative Krieger. It's been a while since I've looked at the information. I know last session the legislature invested in an additional $1 million through the CASA program. I'm also aware that several foundations came forward to provide, I think, another $1 million for CASA statewide to enhance the administrative capacity of those local CASA programs so they can generate more volunteers locally. Last I checked, I think we were close to 40 to 45% of kids had a CASA.
There's some place we need to invest to make sure that that happens. Another follow-up, Mr. Chair, and maybe Bill. Is Bill here?
Yes.
Yeah, he's hiding over there. We've been told about the importance of legal representation and that these kids don't have an attorney early enough in the process. I'd like to have them have an attorney the same day they come into the program. I would hope that the new chair, when they come back, that we would have either the Chief Justice, Paul Dominguez, or Judge Brewer come in and talk to us about how they view the importance of the attorney being available and present for the child and the family as soon as possible, because a lot of what we're finding is because there wasn't proper legal counsel. And the first sensitive review committee that we did, you were on that. The attorney had 22 of those things filed, so they, get them disbarred. 22 of them and was disbarred by the time we got to or gave up the practice. So having good legal representation, I think, is extremely important. And when it goes to the appeals process, when there is a difference, a lot of this would have been taken care of. And also, making sure that parents who have abused their kids, that we don't want to get back. They've always got that hope. Part of that is that the attorney can make them aware of the reality of their situation, that they aren't going to get their kids back. This false hope also creates this time lag in there. And just one other thing, and I'll leave it then, is this week, last week, the week before, the main problem that I see is not with the removal of the kids. It's not that the parents haven't done something wrong. It's that the grandparents are being penalized and not given visitation or adoption. That still comes to the top weekly. Now, if I see it, and if she sees it, and I know Representative Richardson sees it, and Schaffer sees it, I cannot understand why this department hasn't worked more aggressively to address it. We've got that to meet. We'll get more off your back and off my back and more justice in the system than anything else we can do. If the grandparents haven't abused the children, and if you go through a study to make sure they're not alcoholics or drug users, they've got a proper home for them. And the main one is, the thing I hear daily almost, is, well, the grandparents can't have the children because their son, who was the abuser, might come by. That can be taken care of easily, and that's not being done. So that's just, I hope you'll work towards doing that, because that will get more credibility to your agency than anything else you can do.
Bill.
Right. Representative Krieger has mentioned the issue of representation. You may remember, at least some of you from last session, from the Judiciary Committee, and it was discussions I remember in the Senate Judiciary Committee. There's a study out of the state of Washington that was done that shows that if you have counsel, competent counsel, and for the family, it reduces the length of time the kid spends in foster care and reduces the likelihood that the parental rights will be terminated. And studies beyond that show that if a kid possibly can stay with the parents, particularly if it has to be a safe environment, the kid does better than they do in foster care. At the request of the chair, I'm having a discussion with Juvenile Rights Project and Ingrid Swanson, who heads up Injured Defense, along these lines, because one of the things that they have talked about is possibly a pilot project, but possibly money that would, and obviously in this
economic environment, that's a hard thing to talk about, that would give more resources to the lawyers in the dependency area so that they could hire people who do social work, who would complement the attorney and free the attorney up from that end of it. Because that's what a lot of the lawyers do, is they force the system to provide the services. Many of them know the system very, very well. They've been practicing in the area longer than the caseworker's been there. And they also help educate the caseworker and enforce that those services be provided to the kid, the right services. I think that's one of the benefits that comes from that.
Senator Wissett and then Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I would suggest that if the legislators were allowed to pick a group of children to attend Mahonia Hall, we might have a different outcome. I think that at least a third of my staff time is related to foster care issues. And following up on Representative Krieger's comments about grandparents, we've had a couple of just the most egregious cases where and they were all eventually resolved in favor of the children being with their grandparents. One of them was in Lakeview. We were able to intervene along with Representative Garrard's office and finally get these grandparents in Lakeview at least a hearing, and then they ended up with the children. And the other was a non-biological grandparents in Klamath Falls that wanted a couple of children that were had been abused, and both of their parents were in prison. They were unable to even get counseling from the Klamath Falls office. And after Representative Garrard's office and my office worked through DHS, we finally got them to be certified in Jackson County, and they had to drive to Jackson County in order to get their education and certification so they could take the children. So something is clearly broken. There was nothing wrong with either of these two grandparent situations other than the fact that they couldn't navigate the Department of Human Services systems because somebody was throwing a cross-body block on them for whatever reason. That's just in my district, mm-hmm. and that's just two of many examples. And I'm sure that most of us here around the table could go on with that. The question I would ask is, the citizen review boards are the eyes and ears of the courts. And I've seen some of the most scathing citizen review board reviews of Department of Human Services responses. I would wonder, does the Department of Human Services and their foster care program, do you make any attempt to interface with the citizen review boards and actually try to determine what they are seeing and what their interpretation of the results are?
Co-Chair Senator Wissett, thank you for the question. Yes, we do. We're very connected at the statewide level and, you know, with varying degrees of connectivity at the local level. I actually just spent quite a bit of time in Gold Beach working with the local Citizen Review Board and our DHS staff to review their local data. At the state level, we were noticing, the Executive Director of the Citizen Review Board and myself were noticing, that there were several findings often of no reasonable efforts being made in that community. And so we went down to the community and had a facilitated conversation between the Citizen Review Board, the court, the local juvenile judges, myself, the CASA program, our staff. And of course could do more, but make every effort to stay connected to those areas where either in a particular case or more systemically the Citizen Review Board is making findings that reflect that say that our casework is not what it should be, that we're not making the efforts that we should be making to return a child to a parent or to get the child into a more permanent placement.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Aaron, you mentioned that the modest decline in Oregon's foster care placements, I think, in your earlier comments, and Mr. Taylor referred to the Washington report a couple of years ago. We saw that with approximately double the population, they had a significantly lower placement rate mm-hmm. in the foster care system. Has there been an ongoing look and analysis as to some of the systemic reasons there? why Oregon's placement rate is higher?
Co-chairs, Representative Flores, we several years ago, we actually commissioned two independent national reviews to look specifically at what is happening currently in foster care, why decisions are being made around removal. And they concluded that really two things. One, we needed to strengthen our current policies around the issue of safety, not just at the point of removal, but also throughout the life of the case. And also that we needed to adopt a training process for new policy that would ensure that we standardized and made more consistent statewide our practice in that area. We believe that with the implementation this last year of the Oregon safety model that we have been able to make great strides. We continue to train all of our staff and supervisors around that issue. There are several other issues, however, that I think are important that we're working on addressing. One is our ability to provide resources on the front end to families so that we can have safety plans in place that will allow us and the courts and the community to feel comfortable leaving a child in a situation in which we've founded a report of abuse or neglect, but we would like to be able to continue that child in that placement. So efforts around some additional supports on the front end for families are being made, but currently we have a program that's called Family-Based Services that serves not just families on that front end, but also families for whom children are returned. And we are aware that the resources in that program really only have the capacity to serve about 20% of the need. So that is a very significant issue for us. Other issues we've been looking seriously at are things like the drivers around what brings a child into care in the first place. Last session, the legislature invested over $10 million for the first time in a targeted package of addiction and treatment money that looks just to pay for services for families who are involved in child welfare. That investment is having a significant impact on our ability to get those families the treatment they need, which is often the only barrier between them keeping their child at home or getting their child returned home to them, and our effort to avoid having to remove the child. We've also, last legislative session, expanded the capacity of resource on the opposite side of the spectrum in our TANF program for a program that's called Family Supports and Connections, an opportunity for us when a family comes in the door through our Temporary Assistance for Needy Family programs and is identified as being at high risk of entering child welfare to intervene earlier and avoid having to get involved in that family's lives. So there are a series of strategies that I think we've tried to really embrace. We've got more work to do. We're continuing to identify strategies. What I'd like to be able to also do for the committee, in addition to providing you, if you're interested, with some information more about our caseload workload transition, is also to give you a more full report on what we're doing around the issues with relatives, because as both Representative Krieger and Senator Whitsitt have very astutely pointed out, there are really two areas where this continues to be a challenge for us. One is on the very front end, very, very early on, as Kevin alluded to, identifying both relatives as well as people known to the children that we can place a child with and avoid entry into foster care, how we can engage relatives differently, not just as placement options, but also as continuing supports for families. And I think that when you see some of the strategies that we're really embarking on in that arena, that will also have a very significant impact on our efforts to really change the tide in terms of the removal that can happen in a family.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Aaron or Kevin, do we have any sense of how much Oregon spends on our foster care system per child compared to the state of Washington?
Representative Shields, we actually are in the process right now of coming up with our actual numbers on per case. We actually just meeting about that. One of the challenges we have, and we can certainly do more work with the state of Washington, is sometimes we start mixing apples and oranges based on their system, which is when we've taken some of the numbers and followed up on Representative Flores' question, when we take some of the numbers and look at how they measure kids and or children in care and different things, it is different than ours. So we always have to go in more of a fine-tooth comb and say, is this the same as what we've got? So,
could you try to get that information to the committee if best guess you could? And could I ask a follow-up, too?
You may.
I think you're all absolutely right when it comes to public defense services. It's been chronically underfunded for a long time. And we had the same presentation in the Public Safety Strategies Task Force, as well as a presentation by Terry Levy and Michael Orleans, who are experts in training foster parents to really turn their homes not just into, a house that keeps kids safe, but to really turn them, the foster parents, into healing parents. In fact, they authored a book entitled Healing Parents. A lot of times, in my view, foster parents are seen as, just kind of taken for granted. And I think that's, in my district, how a lot of foster parents have expressed to me they feel. I was wondering if you could tell us how Oregon ranks in reimbursement rates and if there's any rankings that have been done on foster parent training. And then thirdly, looking at this list of kind of the number of placements that kids go through, is there any evidence in the literature that there might be an association between reimbursement rates, supports, training for foster parents, and the number of placements that kids might get cycled through?
Certainly, Representative Shields, that's quite the mouthful, and I appreciate how much work you've been doing in this area. And I understand there's actually a new report out right now that just came out from the National Organization. I quite frankly haven't got all the way through it. I just got it 2 days ago that actually starts speaking to what are the retention issues with foster parents and why do they leave and how much does the reimbursement rate for them actually factor into that decision-making. So in Oregon, we actually are one of the lower states in reimbursement of foster parents, and there's a national study that came out 2 years ago called Minimally Adequate Rates for Children, and it's a foster care study that went in and looked at all the states and what states are paying for the basic cost of care for a child, room and board, supervision, clothing, school, whatnot. And we actually rank pretty low on the scale, and to the extent where some age groups we have, according to the study, we are anywhere from 30 to 57% below some of the national averages. So there's that report. And we're doing work right now on a project called Rate Redesign, where we're actually re-looking at how we are reimbursing foster parents, both on the base rate and for children with special needs that need additional supervision and or medical care, and having to redesign how it is we're going to reimburse foster parents, and really base it on some new methodology to say, if indeed this national study, Minimally Adequate Rates for Children, called referred to as the MARC, if that is indeed the study that's out there, how do we compare to that? And if we can afford that, do we move up there? If we can't afford it, at least identify where is the gap and figure out how it is we can slowly close that gap. So that's the analysis we're doing right now on a project called Rate Redesign, where we've got a number of committees working on that. The other piece, though, Representative Shields, that you bring up around the placement stability and how often is it that it's the wrong placement for a child and so they cycle through a number of foster homes, that's where you start getting in some of the real big numbers of kids where it may be the same young person who cycled through 10 or 15 different homes because of the placement match issue, that they chose not to be there, the foster parent chose not for them not to stay, or we didn't have the adequate resource that they really needed a higher level of care. So maybe these children actually needed a residential type placement and we didn't have that available at the time, so they went to a foster home hoping we're going to get a placement over here. That didn't work out. They went somewhere else, always awaiting for the placement. During this last year, we've done a lot of work on our behavioral rehabilitation services and have redesigned many of those services with a goal of identifying those types of placements that these children need that are not ones that we had, 2 and 3 years ago, but also that are longer term. So they're not just a 30-day stay. Can they be in 90 days to really stabilize the child? So I think it's really coming out from several different angles, but really from the foster parent perspective, they really talk about they're really the last ones to call uncle on these kids. They are really in there over and over and over, regardless of whether it's $13 a day, $14 a day. They're there for the child first and foremost, and I think it's important to keep that in mind as we look at what are foster parents' reasons for staying in the system and for helping kids are. It's really not about that reimbursement rate, but that does factor into decisions at times.
Just one final comment.
Very good.
I wanted to suggest that there might be an additional option there, that not only is the placement perhaps not adequate, but that maybe with just a little bit of training, a little bit of extra work, a little bit more support for the foster parents, that they might be able to handle the kid who gets dropped off at their place at 6 o'clock on a Friday, after. And I think that was what Dr. Levy and Mr. Orleans were getting at, is that if just a little bit of training with a little bit more skills, that you might be able to keep that kid from going into a BRS kind of environment as well.
Correct. Representative Cameron.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a comment probably versus a question. I know here in Marion County, when we talk about the increase in foster care, I think, there's a good example here where, because of the emphasis put on the by the meth strike force here, we had an increase. We knew we were going to have an increase. So it's hard to, it's difficult at times to say, is that a bad thing or a good thing? Because I think when you're pushing on one side of the balloon, something else, consequences come out. And I know here that there's been a concerted effort to try to really work hard for that increase that we've had. But it's just an observation. Sometimes the numbers go up, and we can explain specifically why here locally.
Very good. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Aaron, you mentioned in your earlier remarks that there's a requirement, and I believe you said it's statutory, that the children are checked on every 30 days and that you had about an 80% compliance with that. And this may be addressed eventually by the change from the caseload to the workload model, but in the meantime, how is a decision made regarding the other 20%, and what happens in terms of do they just skip a month, or is it a little longer than a month until someone checks? How are those decisions made? Are there priorities in terms of who gets into the 80% and who's in the 20%? Thank you.
Co-Chair Senator Bonamici, thank you. It's in rule, actually not statute, in rule that we see children every 30 days, and also then every 60 days that we actually see them in their caregiving environment. And no, there's no priority order. What I've observed is that if you're not meeting the target, it typically is for one of two reasons. One reason sometimes can be that you are so overworked you haven't had time to enter into the data system that you actually paid a visit to the child, but you did visit the child or see the child in a school environment or a visit. The second reason is that, in fact, you missed by a couple of weeks or a week or a day the 30-day target, and we are pretty adamant about the exact 30-day reporting number that we have, and so there's no priority order given to children. There are some children, quite honestly, through our who are placed outside the state of Oregon, who are with relatives or placements outside the state who are in our legal custody, for whom we would not be able to personally make that 30-day visit requirement. But that's a very, very small number of them. So otherwise, typically the issue is the data entry or just the lag time that often can occur because of the workload challenge.
Thank you.
Since you're going to be coming back with other information, I don't need a response now, but what I'd like for that to include is what following what Representative Krieger has brought up. Understanding we have a caseload model now, working to go to the workload model, I'd like to see what the national rankings are for the number of workers we have, the number of cases we have, and then also we know that the need of how much money is needed to actually get the level of caseworkers to the point where we can actually drop the caseload or the workload down, and the impact it will actually have on that workload. As we all know, money's tight, but these are issues that we need to be able to have the discussions, and we can make policy decisions. Hopefully Ways and Means will be able to help fund some of this stuff, but clearly without the revenue or resources to actually have the number of people, we're not going to be making the headways that we feel that we need to do. But so if you can get us that information, then we can assimilate it into our process.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
We had discussed earlier with the State Bar about it, some enhanced training for attorneys that wanted to work in this field, to get more to come into this field, because we're losing some of those that are doing it. But just one last thing on the dollar of compensation. I think it's $45 an hour now, isn't it, Bill? Indigent defense.
I think it is. I'm looking at
And my plumber cost me $80. We need to understand they cannot spend the time that they need to or have any assistance at all. And that investment up front, I think when the courts talk to us, maybe Paul Domenech, the Chief Justice, will better understand. We've heard it in the work groups, but I think it needs to come back to this committee and make sure we understand the value of that enhanced legal representation and how it saves us dollars and it does something for the kids and families up front.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I came across the study that you were talking about on reimbursement rates, and it's quite sobering. It says that Oregon is among 9 states that would need to raise their reimbursement rates for foster parents by 76% to 100% in order to be minimally adequate, 76% to 100%. So I think while we're expressing our concerns with the department, I think we also need to realize that there are about 3 or 4, maybe 5 different areas of their operations that are chronically underfunded.
Anything further for Senator Barker?
Thanks for coming in. And everybody acknowledges there's problems, but there's an awful lot of kids that are going through that process and are getting a lot of help, where you're doing a great job. And I know the legislature, we imposed the grandparents first kind of clause on you, and I know where you get between a rock and a hard spot. Suddenly the Mexican grandmother wanted her grandchildren, and then there was this huge outcry about that, and that, oh my God, we can't do that. And I also have seen, I'm a retired cop, and I would see the families in Portland that were just heavily involved in criminal activity and probably still are, where grandma would raise mom would raise the kid, and then mom's in prison, and then pretty soon kid's in prison. Now, the original mom's now grandma, raising the next generation to go to prison. I know that Coffee Creek is really trying to break that cycle, which is great. And so there's just all these problems are just huge, and you're going to have even more problems now as the economy of the country is crashing. We're going to see more families in distress, and wish you well, and look for the improvements on the problems that are being identified, but also want to recognize the great work you're doing.
Any further questions or comments? And thank you very much, committee. Thank you, Ms. Kelly Steele, Mr. George. Appreciate that work that you're doing. That concludes our informational meeting. The one remaining item on our agenda is we actually have a report on the Tort Claims Task Force, let's go ahead and pass it out. And I think we won't have a formal presentation on this aside from just a discussion here among those of us here on this side of the dais. Because the majority of us who are here served on the task force, so it's pretty familiar ground to many of you. But what you have here is the 2-page summary that is front and back of the recommendations from the Tort Claims Task Force, that has resulted in LC drafts, which are among those which will be proposed for introduction and our work session here later today. I was the co-chair, along with Senator Przanski, of the Tort Claims Task Force, I'd just like to walk you briefly through that for the benefit mainly of those who are not on the task force themselves. The first page describes an increase in the cap amounts under the Tort Claims Act that's proposed, which would, for the first time, introduce a split cap level that is a higher cap level for state government, including OHSU, which has been a key player in the negotiations and had a representative on the task force, and then a lower level for other governmental entities. And the cap amount would go to $500,000 per claim and $3 million per occurrence as of July 1, 2010, and then would step up in increments of $100,000 per year or $200,000 per year per occurrence until it reaches $2 million and $4 million, respectively, on July 1, 2014. The local governmental entities, that is, all those other than the state, would be at a 3-to-1 relationship on those caps. That is, they would be at 1/3 of those cap amounts going to on personal injury claims, going to $500,000 on July 1, 2014, and $1 million per occurrence, stepping up at 1/3 of the increments for the state until they reached 1/3 of those higher cap amounts, or $1 million and a third, or 2/3 of $1 million in 2014. Property damage claims would be at $100,000 per claim and $500,000 per occurrence, with CPI applying to all of these amounts after the step increases for the personal injury claims, that is starting in 2014, but immediately on property damage claims. There would be, as under this recommendation from the task force, no distinction between economic and non-economic damages. These new limits would take effect 7-1, that is July 1 of 2009, but for state government, as recommended by some members of the task force, it would be applied to injuries that occurred on or after December 28, 2007. The recommendation provides for expedited review to the Oregon Supreme Court to determine challenges of these new cap amounts under the Clark v. OHSU decision, which held that our tort claims limits currently, which are just $200,000 per in total per personal injury claims, violates the Oregon Constitution on an as-applied basis, as applied to particular fact circumstances. The CPI adjustment that would apply immediately to the property damage claims and eventually to the personal injury claims would be based on it would have a 3% cap and would be based on the index that's shown there in that summary. And then in separate bills, the recommendation for the task force was, in addition to that increase in the cap amounts, to present in separate bills a set of issues that are described in the under the heading on the backside, indemnity issues, which would clarify that the public body can contract to have the private insurance of a party that's working as an agent of a public entity to have their insurance apply, as long as the public body is liable up to the tort claim limits. And also would provide for an assignment provision, which I'm just refreshing myself on here as I read. that is, yeah, would clarify that the public body has the right to challenge if it's sued under an assignment of the claim for indemnification by an employee or agent of the public entity. They wouldn't think that employee or agent couldn't resolve the amount of liability and then without the public entity having a chance to challenge. And then the third piece of legislation that was drafted is would provide that because we have this now under this proposal, we would have a split level of caps, regulate the function by which the state might assign responsibilities to a local government entity, and would avoid the result where the state could avoid responsibility for the higher cap amount by simply assigning what are state functions to a local government. So that's a very kind of quick once over the work of the task force, and I realize that it's a rehash for many of you, but did want to get that out on the table because we will be acting on this LCs today among all the others we have. Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Whitsitt.
So each of these head paragraphs is a separate bill draft. Is it going to be an LC?
There are three LCs, one of them on the cap amounts, okay. So what is on the one side of this one pager is in one LC, and then the what's in the each of these others, the
this
indemnity
is,
issues.
This is two, and then it's a three?
Yes.
Okay. And it was AOC, LOC on the task force? Are they part of the task force? I have an email from my county commissioners want to know.
The AOC did not have a voting member on the task force, but we did have Paul Snyder.
Bill Blair.
I beg your pardon. Bill Blair is his county counsel for Washington County.
Right.
Yeah.
And Mr. Snyder also gave us comment from the association's perspective during
thank
the
you. Yes, yes. Thank you. Any other questions about the recommendation from the task force? Then, if not, we have quite a stack of LC drafts for introduction. This, I understand, is the last committee to be meeting this month, and so it's an opportunity to introduce bills. So we have a lot of bills that aren't necessarily a judiciary bill.
Actually, just correct the record. I spoke with Representative Hovey last night at another event. He said that he had his committee scheduled to meet yesterday. For whatever reason, they didn't. So they're going to actually be the last committee to meet on the House side on the 18th. So I assume.
Those of you who scurried to get LC drafts in our hand, thinking the train was leaving the station, there is another train.
I told them. I said, beware. There'll be a few more cabooses coming your way.
Okay, but we have quite a stack, and including some bills that are not necessarily. The Judiciary Committee subject matter, and it was suggested earlier we ought to take a recess here for just to make sure that we have refined this list, or are we...
I do have one question, Mr. Chair. Does this mean that you want us to set a meeting now for December 19th?
No, I think the people who came here to see their favorite LC introduced probably would be disappointed if they had to go away.
If we could, because literally as we were in meetings, we had people come up to us and say, gee, I really don't want my bill forward now, and that was something from a year and a half ago, and I think it would just help for a second to make sure we have everything. You will see notebooks here, around here. We don't have notebooks for everyone because bills are the size of two New York City phone directories. And if anyone wants a particular copy of a particular bill, we'll be glad to get it to them, probably by email. I know there are people in the audience who are anticipating bills. One of the problems we're handicapped or under is that our office is 2 miles from here because of the fire. We do not have a photocopying machine close by. We are also in the process of moving back to the building Christmas week, so we're in the process of putting everything in the boxes. But we do have several copies of the bills here. You do have a sheet of the bills here, and yes, if we could just take a break for a few minutes, maybe in place.
We will take a break. Yeah, maybe rather than recess, maybe a break for in place is the better move. Then just so we have an opportunity, people can have an interest in scanning through this list and looking at them. There are binders here that have the full LCs to the extent you want to look at them, we have. Binder over here as well, and of course the action that would be proposed for today is to introduce these as committee bills, which with the standard understanding that it makes no commitment as to one's support for the legislation in the regular session, and in fact there are some of us here who won't be part of that session, so It will fall to others to ultimately make the decision.
What about the cases that say pending? We're going to still introduce those, the number, get that number in?
We'll have a clarification on that. I think there's right now.
I think we'll do that here.
Mr. Chair,
now.
Members of the committee, I'm Anna Braun, the other counsel for the Judiciary Committee, and we have the ability as a committee to approve the drafts and concept, and then the paper will be done within a week. So we can do it that way.
Okay. So we're going to take a break. We'll go off the record to allow members to scan the list, but we can't really be talking about the substances of the stuff off the record. So we'll have to go back on the record before we do that.
I will open a work session of the House Interim Judiciary Committee here on Thursday, December 11, 2008.
And I will also open up the work session for the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary for the purpose of bill introductions.
And our work session is for that same purpose. Members, we have a list in front of you that's gotten a little bit refined. The LC 47 and LC 1463 have been stricken from the list. You can cross those out. There are a number here that are listed as pending, which means that we don't have LC drafts in hand, but expect them shortly. And based on the relating clause and the pending project, we would ask for approval to have them introduced as committee bills along with the others. And there's one item that's listed as pending, LC 1452, which is the increase in the caps under the Tort Claims Act, that is for which we did just today receive the LC draft. So you could cross out pending if you wish after that item.
A few others that we need to just put on the record.
Okay.
Besides, these are the ones that are being taken off the list. Besides LC 47, we also have LC 235 on the bottom of page 1, the asset forfeiture one. That will be coming in later. We also have the LC 1463 dealing with metal theft is coming off, as well as LC 1711 on the next page, page 4, which will be coming off. We will be including LC 2118 as an inclusion, which is not currently on the list, so you may want to note that. I do want to say regarding LC 1463, which is the metal theft, what has happened is my goal was to introduce that as a committee bill and then allow every member on both sides to be able to sign on as co-chief sponsor if they chose to do so. I've been told that we shouldn't be using a committee bill to do that because it kind of runs amok to what committee bills are. So we will pull that off. I will introduce that as one of my bills. But before it goes in, we're going to make certain that every member on the House and on the Senate side have the opportunity, if they want to, sign on to that bill. And that will be the vehicle that we will use for metal theft during the session. So that's a disclaimer and acknowledgement as to how we've decided that we want to make certain that everyone who wants to be a sponsor of that bill, knowing the impact it has statewide, has that opportunity.
Senator, I'm sorry, you said 2118, but you didn't say what that was.
2118, and Bill, you've got that draft.
Yeah, we just got it. It's JD 12-9. 08 permits owner of improvement of land that seeks release of lien perfected against improvement or land to file a surety bond. A deposit money with escrow agent instead of county recorder or county treasurer. And this is relating to the value given for release of lien. Pretty narrow relating to it.
Okay. Yeah. It's for us. Let me just go ahead and give a disclaimer here. Representative McPherson has already mentioned this before we took our break, but as all of us know, the Interim Judiciary Committee's during the pre-session file legislation for the sole purpose of expediting judiciary business for the upcoming session. We also open it up for as a courtesy to other committees, individuals, or agencies and interest groups to provide for a mechanism to get something pre-session filed. That's what we're doing today, and everyone should realize, and I want to put on the record for those who are hearing or listening and watching this in the future, a vote of introduction of a measure today does not necessarily indicate a member support for the measure at this time or any time in the future. It does not guarantee leadership will send a bill to the actual judiciary committees or that such bill will even receive a hearing. And with that said, I would like to move forward with the motion at this point. And Bill, if you'd give that motion, frame it, or did you want me to go ahead and do that?
Mr. Chair, I guess that we have, as you know, the bills either have to go to the House or Senate. We have, from all the people requesting these bills, because we saw it from them, if they can give it to us where they want the bills to start. That would be a decision that traditionally, and this will be my 12th bill introduction meeting, the chairs make a decision they make after the committee meeting as to where, because you are the ones that have to sign the bill back, all 60 to 70 of them, depending on the chamber each. So probably to facilitate the process, make a motion that the House adopt, recommend that all these bills go forward, and that the Senate do the same thing. And then after the meeting with you and whomever else you want, the staff will sit down and go through the list that we have from the sponsor, the people who have asked us to file the bills, and then determine which chamber the bill will start in. If I also could add, I know there's been some comments about duplicate of bills here. We file, as for the last three or four sessions, a lot of bills, several bills, a dozen bills and so on, each chamber with very broad relating clauses. I know Representative Krieger will remember this when he's chair, that we do use a lot of those bills during session, particularly when we get beyond the bill drafting deadline. And you may remember, we use these bills, for example, in the creation of the meth package two sessions ago. So you may see kind of strange-looking bills. Many of them will serve worthwhile process of worthwhile endeavors later on. It frankly, what it does, it gives the system greater flexibility later on down during when we get into March and April session.
Okay. And just to refine it for the purposes of the House action, what the I would invite a motion then from or for the House committee to introduce all the LCs that are listed here on the that has been passed out to you, three sheets, five separate pages of content as judiciary committee bills, subject to the decision of the chairs about which of these bills will be introduced on the House side as opposed to the Senate side. Do I hear such a motion?
So moved.
And at the same time, I would also take a motion from the Senate side to do the same with the notation that of the bills that we've said that are on the list that will not move forward today and the inclusion of the additional one that was not on the list.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
We've heard the motion, members. Any discussion of the motion? Any objection? Then the House committee has introduced the list of bills under the terms just described.
And for the Senate, if is there any discussion, any objection, the motion carries, and we'll also deal with that today as to the assignment of the various LCs to the particular chambers that they will actually be introduced.
Okay. That concludes the work session of the House Interim Judiciary Committee, which I will now close. That concludes all of our business here today, and this is the last meeting of our Interim Judiciary Committee, and I want to say to all the members of the House Interim Judiciary Committee, it's been a pleasure to serve with you, both on this committee and in the chamber as a whole, and extend my best wishes to all of you in the for the upcoming session, which is going to present some particular challenges. Challenges that Representative Flores and I will not be having to carry forward well along with you, but we wish you well in that. It's been my pleasure to serve with her in the same entering class in the House that came in 2003, and appreciate her good work on the Judiciary Committee here with me.
And from the Senate side, I also want to thank everyone who's been working in the interim. This is one of those work task committees, as we know, that we were asked to carry a lot of issues forward. I think we did a very good job in getting things ready for the 2009 session. I also want to recognize Representative Flores and Representative McPherson for all the work that you did, not only through this interim period, but through your service to the state. And I hope that you will both stay involved and engaged
at some level, knowing of your skill sets and the ability to really represent your districts and serve the people of Oregon. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, with that, all our business is done. We're adjourned.
And the Senate will close its work session, and we are adjourned for the interim committee today.